The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
So today we're going back to the textbook. Dealing with the cultural determinists, people who believe that human behavior is determined overwhelmingly by the culture, by our education in our respective cultures, and biology is of much lesser importance to some. They act as if it's not important at all. So I posed these questions so you would get the major points out of the chapter. Alcock, near the beginning, points out this, what he calls a false dichotomy that's often used by persons arguing against the relevance of biology in understanding people. And he quotes sociologists, cultural anthropologists. Earlier in the book, he's quoted feminists and some educators about the same kind of thing. So we've dealt with this problem before. So what's the false dichotomy that he's talking about? It's when they say our behavior, human behavior, is determined either by culture or biology. Like it's got to be one or the other. That's really a false dichotomy. It's like saying, well, I know that so-and-so smiles at me because he's learned that I'm nicer to him when I smile at him. Well, sure, that's something you learn. But does that mean biology has nothing to do with it? You know, we know that smiling is an inherited fixed action pattern. And it's fairly easy to demonstrate that. It's present across cultures. It's present very early in life. It's present regardless of the kind of training people get. It's really a false dichotomy to present this. The people that make the argument against, of course, it's used against sociobiology. People claim that it's actually harmful to refer to our inherited behavior, to explain behavior, because they have a great fear that such explanations will be used to justify bad behavior or evil behavior. You know, but they argue that that if we talk about the relevance of biology, we're saying that, you know, our genes determine our behavior. But that's never what sociobiologists are saying, or at least rarely so. There are, in some animals, there are fixed action patterns that occur with very little input from their environment, but most behaviors require both experience and to develop, and as well as the biological basis and the nervous system. Now, I want to spend a little time on the next couple of questions to understand, you know, why Alcock is so concerned about this, because it's very important in the history of science. And it's particularly enlightening to look at the writings of Margaret Mead. How many of you know who Margaret Mead is? See, her books have been so popular, and her book, Coming of Age in Samoa, became very popular in the U.S., other places in the world too. It was written back in 1928. But first of all, what was Margaret Mead claiming? that, but that would be the first point I want you to understand. What did she claim? Yeah.
She doesn't think the Samoans have a different attitude towards teenage sex. And that cultures determine your attitudes, that sort of thing. And that they're a lot of different
girls. Yeah, she certainly believed that cultural was the determinant. And she said, to show that, I'll find a culture where attitudes towards something that's important in our culture are very different in their culture, just because they have a different culture, so they learn different things. And so she spent, and I was amazed to realize that she spent so little time. She was only there for like 12 weeks studying, mainly interviewing a group of 25 young women about their sexual practices, attitudes, and so forth. She was interested in the transition from childhood to adulthood. So she focused on, and she focused particularly on women to get her information. She had done only a brief study of the language, so she had only the rudiments of Samoan language. And she claimed that their attitudes were totally different. They were totally permissive. They could experiment with sexuality without any impedance from adults. It was completely free. They never developed anxieties about it. They never developed hang-ups. She said there was no rape, you know, anything like that, because of these attitudes. It's sort of an idyllic view of human, the possibilities of human culture. So if we just take that to heart, maybe we could change our culture and have less of these problems. The only problem is that she was wrong. So the question is, how do we know she was wrong? And why was she wrong? Why was she so wrong? She was, her teacher, her cultural anthropologist teacher was Frank Boas, who was a cultural determinist. He did not believe that we inherit any relevant behavior that he was concerned with. And if you look, he quotes some very relevant parts of it about how she did it, what she found, and so forth. She wanted to contrast this with the emotional turbulence in American culture among kids, adolescents, growing up. Well, Derek Freeman went to Samoa later and didn't spend just a few months. He spent years studying their behavior, okay? And he found that just about every major point she had made was incorrect. He published a book in 1983 where he documented his findings. He found that premarital sex, for example, was not common, was not promiscuous, was not accepted calmly by adults, not part of a laid-back society with relaxed rules about sexuality. And he interviewed the same women, of course they were older now, that Margaret Mead had interviewed before. He even looked at Mead's own records and found out that 14 of the 25 had never reported any sexual activity before they got married, so they didn't fit what she said in the first place. In fact, they valued virginity. There was a whole cult of virginity in the culture. He found out that the relatives were not at all indifferent about their young female relatives and their sexual activities and mating activities. He found that rape did occur in the society. So the question is, why did Margaret Mead make such errors?
Did she?
Sorry?
Did she?
Say it again.
Or did she?
She did make the errors because he presented a very credible account. He was there much longer and actually observed behavior. He did it in a much greater variety of more acceptable standards for behavioral studies than she had done. I mean, remember what she was doing. She was interviewing these young women. And she didn't know the language very well. And some of the women even told her later, we were fooling. It was a big joke to them. They told her what she wanted to hear. This is what she wanted to hear. So they made a big joke out of it. She obviously, you know, these are not dumb people. They're sophisticated people. They just don't have American educations, you know. So he attributes, this is the way Alcock summarized it, she was there, she was inexperienced as a field worker. You know. She was there a very short time on the project. She was relatively unfamiliar with the language. She was unable to see that her female informants were kidding her when they spoke of their sexual adventures. The misinformation she had received from her colleague about Samoan culture was misinformation. Above all, she wore ideological blinders that she had acquired from Boaz, her teacher, and his other students. So she saw what she wanted to see, namely that cultural norms were the arbitrary products of human invention. Well, as you can imagine, when Freeman's book first came out, I mean, Mead had been popular for a long time. She was like the foremost American cultural anthropologist. She was well recognized. And then this book appears saying that she was full of it. It created a huge uproar. Sorry? 83. Hers was 28. So just think how long she had been recognized and believed. I mean, I knew about her work and didn't see any reason to disbelieve it. She was seemed to be a good cultural anthropologist and so forth. But, you know, I wasn't familiar with field work either at that time and had no way of criticizing it. But this guy was there on Samoa studying them, that those people for years, got to know these people much better than she had, much better. And even some of the same people that had participated in her study.
Jerry, isn't it interesting that the students might find it interesting this subject is so sensitive about the research on with people, you know, what I'm doing now with the educational technology, and look at the research over the last 30 years, it is so full of anecdotes and misinterpretations of data because people aren't collecting the data in a scientific way. It's still an incredible problem in psychology, sociology, and education. Very hard to get out of that.
That's right. The ideas are pretty entrenched in the education field. So that's what we're dealing with when we present something different. So anyway, I want you to understand that what she claimed, how she came to her views, and why was she so wrong. So read that if you need to, but I've stated the major things about it. Yeah.
So she went there like in the 1920s?
In the 20s.
Even like in what decade? something like the 70s?
70s, yeah.
Could there have been a difference of like generations in that time? Or?
That was why it was important that he interviewed some of the very same people.
Oh, okay.
He interviewed older people as well as younger people. She had focused just on the young people, you see.
Like, had there been any...
And
like
she was making claims also about older people's attitudes, but she didn't get to know the older people at all. She didn't know the language well enough, you see. So that was the problem. I mean, he's written a very thorough book about it, and it would be worth getting the book just for the historical interest. I mean, she's still a well-known name. You know, after so many years of being so recognized, some people never heard of Derek Freeman, but they know Margaret Mead. So she made a reputation and she got tenure and everything else. But I just want, it's an interesting part of history of science to know these things, because this certainly isn't the first time and won't be the last that kind of things happened. So we've talked about this before, blank slate view of human nature. And first I want you to look at Gould's claim about he called it biological potentiality. And he contrasted that with what he called biological determinism. He said that biological determinism is what sociobiologists claimed. He said, well, of course, we inherit the potential. Our biology gives us the potential to do this, that, and the other thing. But he said they don't determine, it doesn't determine our behavior. And here's what he even uses the frame. He says the phrase, we have this biological potentiality with a brain capable of a full range of human behaviors and predisposed towards none. That's what he said. And that's sociobiology would completely oppose and present plenty of evidence against. Okay, against the idea of biological determinism with specific genes for specific behavioral traits. See, he was always fighting at what we really consider a straw man now, because that's not what sociobiologists claim. As Alcott puts it, he says, Gould did not then explain, indeed he has never explained, how the concept of an amorphous biological potentiality differs from a non-biological environmentalism. That is the cultural determinism of Boas and Mead. Yes, people have genes that survive past natural selection, but their only developmental function is to help provide us with an all-purpose learning ability which is used without any predisposing biases as an enculturating device, you see. So he's saying that what Gould claims there, he will give biology lip service, but in fact, his views don't differ from the views of Mead and Boas, the cultural determinists. Okay. So the second thing there, I thought was also very interesting. He talks about, he has a section there on shortcomings of blank slate theory. And he talks about the lack of vigorous tests of their ideas. We'll call them really vigorous tests. Cultural determinism. You know, they give examples, but they don't really even if Mead had been right. And she found a culture, you know, that was totally different from ours. It turns out they're not, but if, let's say they, she found a culture like that, the kind she was looking for. Would that prove cultural determinism? And Alcock points out that it wouldn't, that finding an exception doesn't argue against a more general situation where you find culture after culture after culture that has restrictive attitudes towards sexuality and so forth. It's probably the only major exception is occurring in recent years with birth control techniques, where there are major changes going on. But until then, you know, most cultures were all very similar. So they often, in the arguments against sociobiology, people are always presenting exceptions. Some people will write things and then they'll give their own selves as an example. You know, well, I chose a man who is poor and he doesn't have resources, and, you know, and he chose me and I can't even have kids and this and that. You know, they'll give this one example as if that proves something. It doesn't prove anything. Well, of course there are exceptions. You know, we're talking about the more general trends that you can get from it requires a lot of data and statistics to get those, to really test the ideas. And Alcock goes through a number of things that a true cultural determinism would predict there that aren't really borne out. But let's go through a few of the other things in this chapter here that were particularly interesting. I'm sorry I wasn't able to scan these pictures, but I remember I asked you to bring your books. And if you have them, turn to the page there, 138 and 139. He's got a table on 138 and a graph on 139 that I want to talk about men's attraction to young women. He's interested here in the attributes that are attractive. These have been shown to have a lot of consistency across cultures and across people within a culture. There's actually probably more variation among men within a culture than there is in the averages across cultures, because we do have a lot of variability, and that's part of our genetic variability. The cultural determinists have argued, and you'll see this in literature studies as well as in anthropology, that the idea of beauty and the idea of love is all cultural determined. It has a historical explanation. It arose in the Middle Ages, and this and that and the other. It, ridiculous arguments, but I've seen it so many times myself in the literature, you know. You have things arising in the Middle Ages where we have good examples that it happened in ancient Israel, it happened in ancient Egypt, we have written records, you know, all these things. And yet, these people will stick with their crazy arguments. So I'm asking here, if you look at these attributes that he's talking about, what is the signal value of these attributes? Is there any general signal value that would fit the way sociobiologists feel? And if you look at that table, you'll look at attributes that they find consistent across cultures. The way they do these studies usually, some of them are done if they're particularly interested in what attributes of the body, physical appearance of the body, they will use pictures, you know, and they will blank out the face, so the person has to, or they'll put the same head or egg on the in the body, so they have to make their decision according to body shape. And then they'll look at attributes of the body, like waist-to-hip ratio has been a popular one since that was studied, and a lot of statistics gathered about it by an Indian lady. Her name was Anand, I remember. First one I remember that came out with it, and it's proven it stood out right across cultures to be a good predictor. So you'll find that on here, waist-to-hip ratio 0.7, you know, the optimum always comes out about that, and its probable signal value, he points out here, is current high estrogen levels, ample fat reserves, good health. Higher probability of becoming pregnant, lower probability of early mortality. Again, these are based on statistics. Other attributes, smooth, unblemished skin, symmetrical faces and limbs, facial averageness. Men aren't attracted to women that look too different from all the others. You know? That's why we have models. They've got to look average. Prominent cheekbones. Why would that be a good signal? Because children don't have prominent cheekbones. So prominent cheekbones don't occur until sexual maturity. So sexual maturity is important too. You want a combination. The signals have to indicate a combination of sexual maturity and youth, health, and fertility. And all these attributes can indicate those things. So health, fertility, sexual maturity, plus youth. Why would youth be so important? If a woman's healthy, she's still fertile, she's sexually mature, why wouldn't she be? And you know, sometimes they are. These are always exceptions, but on the average, it'll be the younger women be more attractive. Why is that? From a sociobiology point of view. Yeah.
Because they can have more kids.
More kids, exactly. They're younger. They've got more time. You know? Because you're interested in the potential for maximum transmission of genes in evolution. Now, don't think of current situation. Think of our evolution. Rosa?
If the man is moving around in an evolutionary advantageous way and not being a woman,
I can't hear you very well.
If the man is moving around, it seems like it shouldn't matter whether any specific man is going to be fast or possible.
Say it again. I can't hear you well.
It seems like if the man can have many things over the course of his lifetime, then he shouldn't care whether any particular one is out because he's not planning to stay with him.
That's true. And there are men that take that option. That's quite true. But overall, there are also reasons why people form monogamous relationships. We went through some of that before, you know, and there are certain situations that favor monogamy more than others, you know. And remember, in human cultures, polygynous activity among men is pretty common, you know, more than among women, more than polyandry among women, though you find that too. And remember the study of the birds that have all these different types of relationships, same as humans. You know, there were particular pressures, selective pressures, why they would move from one type of relationship to another. And you should look at that if you don't remember it, why certain relationships have an advantage in terms of genetic fitness. And whenever you do this kind of thing, don't let religion, morality have any influence, okay? We're just talking about the way birds behave, okay? This is the way they behave, okay? And we can see all the same kinds of things for humans, and probably some of the very same things that we're found in birds, same selective pressures are in humans. And I pointed out how some humans will behave feeling guilty and feeling everything else, and yet they will still go ahead and behave in a certain way, surprising even themselves, because the pressures cause feelings within themselves. Sometimes they can't even verbalize them. They'll still lead them to behave in a certain way. Okay? Because we have these feelings from the inheritance. Yeah?
Does that mean that mindful truth makes that his mom, does that mean that person is insecure about his own survival? Because I remember you had mentioned two instances
Well, you know, we did talk about possible influences on why men are different than the kind of women they select. Now we're talking about how they're similar. Okay? We're going to talk about the similarities. And then the second question would be, well, how do you keep all men, why aren't all men attracted to the same woman and they always fight? Well, sometimes they are. And that happens. But you have a lot of differences, too. And one of the influences, their own mother and so forth, will have an influence on them. And there were probably many. There are probably others, too. Remember, there's a lot of genetic variability and there's a lot of differences. There's always an interaction between those genes and their environment that they grew up in, the learning from their parents and their friends and so forth. So we have a lot of differences, too. Never think the way Gould thinks. Our genes force us to do a certain thing. They don't. But they do create feelings within us that influence the way we behave. And that's what we're talking about. So people, there have been multiple studies like this on the mate choice literature, you know, which became popular only after the rise of sociobiology. And he felt that there were some mate selection things within ethology before, but in sociobiology they became more prominent. And that's when these bird studies were made, and then that led to new looks at human behavior and so forth. You know, the one on waist to hip ratio and all that, that's all fairly recent. That can't be more than 15 years ago when that was discovered.
So does the median age that an individual finds most attractive change with age? Like, the older person,
that's a good question. He doesn't deal with that.
Yeah.
He's dealing with studies that are looking, almost all of them deal with college men, you know, and their preferences. But when they're done, and they look at older men, they're generally attracted pretty similarly. Still attracted to younger women. Still attracted to women that have these signals. But remember, there's all these other considerations too, practical considerations and things, you know. Anyway, it's a pretty interesting area, and it's an interesting literature. And I consider it one of the major contributions of sociobiology to lead us to all these new studies. Okay, now continuing on that, the cross-cultural studies of mating preferences, they found that in doing these, well, there's a couple things. I didn't mention this graph here. The graph isn't looking at waist-to-hip ratio. It's plotting the attractiveness rating given by the men. And they plotted on the abscissa here the body mass index. You know what your body mass index is? It's your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. That's called the body mass index. Okay. And he puts in his table here that the body mass index between 20 and 24 indicates high fertility and low mortality rates. But when you look at the graph here, it actually, the peak preferences here go all the way from body mass index of 16 up to about 24. So it has a broader range and more variability than his table indicates when you look at the actual data. So indicating again there's quite a bit of variability, because somebody with a body mass index of 16 looks very different from someone with a body mass index of 24 or 25, you know. And yet they would have on the average about the same attractiveness. And of course, people will be influenced by their experience, and men will differ quite a bit. But overall, the averages keep coming out about the same. You'll get the same peak in different societies. But in the studies, they wanted to find men who weren't influenced by Madison Avenue advertisements and so forth. They felt that maybe men all prefer the same thing because we're all influenced by the same advertisements, the same TV programs, the same movies, everything else, you know. So they had to find people that had less influence, and they found this one group. It's in Amazonian area, Peru, the Yomi Bato men. And in presenting these pictures, like here, and you see women that are either skinny, more normal looking, or a little overweight, with two different waist to hip ratios, 0.9, 0.7, okay, they found that these men of this particular group chose differently. So what the men in America will always choose this one on the average. Waist to hip ratio 0.7, normal weight. Okay. The Yomi Bato men chose this one. More overweight and with a lower waist to hip ratio. She's got more weight around her middle and she's a little bit overweight. Why? You see. And he doesn't have any final explanation, that because he doesn't want to present one because it hasn't been tested, but he gives his idea about it. He indicates that in their evolution, you know, in a group in a tropical rainforest, high calorie foods are not that easy to acquire. It's pretty difficult for a person ever to get overweight in the conditions that they faced when they were evolving. And we know from studies in other primitive cultures too that that's true. People in those cultures generally get fat only with foods like the Native Americans. Look at the Lakota in South Dakota, where I'm familiar with that area because my mother's family comes from there. My father homesteaded on ground that was used before him only by the Lakota. And before the Europeans came in there, in general, there were no overweight young women at all. There wasn't enough food to do it. They would take on quite a bit of weight when they feasted, and then they would lose it. Okay, so you did have a lot of variation in weight. But in general, there weren't obese people. Okay, but you did have this ability to vary in weight. He doesn't mention this variability.
Jerry, I remember reading a study that said there's an awful lot of, a very significant number of primitive societies today, in the last 50 years, where overweight women were preferable.
Okay, but let me finish the story here about this, because that's true. Okay, that supports what he's saying here. But let's finish the story about the Lakota. What happened when they were no longer able to carry on their nomadic existence and hunt buffalo, what happened to those people? They had to settle down off and around the forts and so forth. They got food from the army. Now where do they get it? Government surplus food gets shipped to those reservations all the time. A lot of it is flour, you know, wheat and other grains, flour. So they eat a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of refined carbohydrates. And there's a lot of obesity now. A lot of people are overweight. And along with it, they have a lot of adult onset diabetes. It's up to like 70% of them among the Lakota have adult onset diabetes that they didn't have before. Maybe they would have had it if they'd been able to get overweight. So it's a big problem. So now the question is, if you deal with how, in their evolution, they weren't like that. Okay, and I don't think there have been any studies now of preferences among the Lakota now, the modern Lakota. I think you would still find that their preferences don't differ much. And that you would also find that the young women, maybe some of them are overweight, but not very many. Okay? Otherwise, those young men would be going off the reservation more looking for women. Okay, but that's my prediction. I don't know if that's been studied. But in this study, the men did make this choice, the slightly heavy woman. So he's got to think of why this could occur. And it would be something like the heavier women were less likely to die of disease, you know, more able to withstand parasites if they got any, and so forth. He doesn't mention all this, but it's easy to think of things, why that might be preferable.
Another theory is that I read years ago was that it was an evolutionary way of saying that this woman probably, because she is well fed, which means that she is a dominant and more likely to be able to feed her young, that's evidence because she's able to be better, obtain more high caloric food than other similar women.
Yeah.
That's why men.
Okay, and these are interesting explanations, and you do find these preferences, for example, in cultures like India. Being overweight indicates you have more money, because the people that don't have money, the poor, can't eat enough food to get overweight, unless they're very good beggars. I've seen a few beggars that are overweight because they get so much, they take in so much in their begging, but most of them are not. They're quite slender people. The vast majority are slender, but among the wealthier people, being overweight, they consider sort of a badge of superiority. But again, that's generally women who are already married. They have very strong cultural taboos against breaking up. It's happening more now because of their strong religious culture. Okay, so again, I don't think it would interfere too much with these kinds of studies. But the way to test, how would you test that idea about the Yamamoto? You'd have to find similar groups, okay, that live in similar conditions and probably evolve in similar conditions. There's other rainforest peoples in Brazil, in Borneo, Sumatra, the Malay Peninsula, and so forth. There's other tribal peoples that similar conditions would apply. You'd have to look at those to find out if there's any consistency. But again, even if it is an exception, one exception doesn't prove very much, okay?
But I think also you have to take into consideration that across the continents, there are different body types. And I know in South America, the females tend to have, they have a larger, I don't know the ratio way, but it's like a larger ratio.
Brazilian men tell me that in Brazil, women are heavier in hips.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I come up to America and women are heavier on top.
Right.
And they notice, you know, on the average, they notice these differences. And of course, they're just paying attention to young women. You know, so is that because of values and the way women dress, or is it really a body type difference? Well, it may be a body type difference. And the reasons for it, you know. Don't know. Whoops. There we go. Okay. So we don't have the answer to that, to those things. But there are ways to test it. Oh, this one. You can certainly help me with this one. About people's strong tendency to stay inactive in groups. He has a long section there. He deals with this. It's a very general tendency that people have. We do have people that are loners, but they're not the average person. Most people want to be in groups and even lead to violent interactions between groups. So this is where he deals with the genocide issue, and you should look at that. He's got a map if you want to see how common genocidal behavior has been. And they only looked at the big example of genocide, many smaller examples too. And it will shock you to read about attitudes of American presidents towards Native Americans, for example. And you will see that some of them are pretty frankly genocidal statements that they made. If you're religious, and many of us are pretty familiar with the Jewish and Christian Bible, he has this interesting statement here where he says that, he quotes somebody, "The Bible is a blueprint of in-group morality, complete with instructions for genocide, enslavement of out-groups, and world domination." Well, a lot of that's true. You think of the stories. I've read most of it. I actually went to a college where all of us minored in the biblical studies. And it was a small college in Illinois. So I read the whole thing, and a lot of these statements are very surprising. But if you take them seriously, you realize where it came from. So my question is here, why? There's nothing peculiar about the Jews in history at all. You find it again and again and again, the same kind of behaviors. What are the fitness benefits? Just think of, why have we inherited such feelings? We want to be in groups. How do they benefit us? Let me start. You're with a group. Your probability of finding a mate you're compatible with is greater. I would put that at the top of the list. But there's many others. If you get in trouble, your probability of being rescued and helped by somebody, if you're in a group, you're on relatives in particular, you're much more likely to be helped, to be rescued. If you get attacked by predators, imagine now you're in a primitive group in our early evolution, you're attacked by predators, where do you have the best chance? By yourself or with a group? Well, obviously with a group, If you're attacked by outsiders, other human groups, well, if you're by yourself, your chance of survival is zero if they're a bit genocidal. Or if you're with a group, you have a chance, So you can keep going down the list. Now talk about food acquisition. If you're by yourself and you need a varied diet to be healthy, your chances of getting that are much less than with a group that's collecting food, sharing it in some way, and able to specialize a bit, in different acquiring, some of them are hunters, some of them are gatherers, some of them are planting things, and some of them are enabling people to do that by taking care of their kids and things like that, And of course that leads to the last one, health and child rearing, health and educating children and so forth. All of these things benefit us when we're with groups. So there's a lot of fitness benefits. You can point directly to the genetic fitness benefits of these various things. Okay. Even though they've also led to some violent behavior, so we also inherit a tendency to reject the outsider, to diminish them, to think of the other groups as a little less human than we are, maybe a lot less human if they become violent. When I was a little kid and we were, I was a little kid in World War II, I thought the Japanese were some kind of insect or something when I first, I was a little kid, not able to understand very much. But the things I was hearing, I didn't think of it as being very human. I remember it very clearly. And of course, growing up, I gradually acquired more of an education. I don't remember being too surprised when I first met someone from Japan and found out they're perfectly nice people. But, this was an attitude that I picked up because of adult attitudes at the time of war. It's a lot easier to go to war against somebody that you don't don't think of as human as you are. So we justify such behavior. And let's face it, dropping the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki is pure genocide. I mean, that is wiping out millions of people. We want to, these are interesting things in his appendix. We won't have time to do it now, but take a look at these. Maybe we'll talk a little bit at the beginning of the next hour about it. Thank you.